Hello everybody, story time with Dutch Mantel, and I'm going to get out of the way very, very quickly. We've got books, we've got t-shirts, you know, the whole spiel and jazz and everything, but I want to introduce Dutch, who is going to introduce our very, very special guest indeed. Take it away.
We have a guest today that I have known for years and years and years, and I've been talking to James, and I said, I need to get him on the show. And I think James has interviewed this gentleman before, and his name is Al Snow. He's sitting by in Louisville, Kentucky right now. Al, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Dutch, and thank you for having me on the show. I really appreciate it.
Love to have you on the show. But first, I might have to swear you in with the wrestler's code of honor. Do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth? So help you, kayfabe. Yes or no?
So help me, kayfabe.
Now he's taken the oath, so he's highly indoctrinated into what we're doing here. Al, are you okay? I mentioned right before we went on the air that from the time I haven't seen you in a long, long time.
Yeah, it's been a while, hasn't it?
Oh, a long time. But I've kept track of you, but your voice sounds different.
Yeah, now I sound like Christian Bale doing Batman all the time. So it's like I'm the vengeance, you know.
So what happened?
I had severe hiccups, chronic hiccups for about 3 weeks, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It was probably one of the worst things I've ever experienced in my entire life. I barely slept for 3 weeks, barely ate. And they gave me antipsychotic medicine to help get rid of it.
Oh, so they knew you, huh?
Yeah. And I mean, it's like some heavy stuff, you know what I mean? Like really, really heavy stuff. So I can't even eat gummies. I can't even eat edibles because they weird me out. So I had some really interesting dreams.
I bet.
We remember Kevin Furtig. He was, we went up right after I got the hiccups were, you know, I was on these antipsychotics, and we went to a wrestling convention in Indianapolis, and he and his wife, Katie, Kevin, let us stay in his house. Typically Dutch, like if I stay at somebody's home, I try to be as unobtrusive as possible. You know what I mean? Just, you know, I don't want to be a problem. So I'm laying there asleep in the middle of the night. I wake up and I've had this dream Now, keep in mind, I'm on antipsychotic medicine. So I have this dream that I'm planning this celebration. And I got to find, I don't know what this is, but I got to find it. And if I find it, it's some tool. It's going to be the best day ever, right? So I wake up out of the dream. I got to go to the bathroom. I'm only in my underwear, right? I don't even think about it. I'd normally put on some sweatpants or something. So if I run into anybody in the house, you know, I'm not just in my underwear. I go in the bathroom. I go to the restroom. And all of a sudden I go to leave and I go, wait a minute, I got to find this. You know, if I find that, it's going to be the best day ever. So I go through their whole bathroom, all their cabinets, all their medicine cabinets. I go through the shower. I take the lid off the tank of the toilet, right? Looking for this. And now, am I done? No. I now proceed to go into Katie and Kevin's bedroom and start searching their closets and their nightstands while they're laying in bed awake watching me do this. So then I go down the hallway, I go in their daughter's bedroom. I went through all the bedrooms upstairs, couldn't find it. So I went downstairs in the kitchen, went through all of their drawers, all of their cabinets, the stove, the refrigerator, and then went throughout the rest of the house. I spent about an hour, hour and a half searching the house looking for this and thinking I was awake the whole time, and then went back to bed and woke up the next morning.
So they didn't wake you up during this?
No, in fact, and I didn't know they were awake until the next morning. I was telling everybody what I had done. I said, I feel terrible. You know, I was wandering around your house, and Kevin's like, oh yeah, we laid there and watched you go into the closet and everything. I go, why didn't you say something? He said, we didn't want to wake you up. I said, well, I thought I was awake the whole time, but.
Well, they may have realized you're like sleepwalking.
Yeah.
You got to be careful waking people up like that.
Yeah,
because I've done that before. Like in Memphis, I used to walk outside my room and walk around just in my shorts.
Would you really?
on the like the walkway, and would see me, and then I would go. I wouldn't be out there long, but I would. I know what it is. Listen, you own a company now.
Yes,
Ohio I do. Ohio Valley Wrestling. Did you? Let me ask you. Do you ever see yourself by owning your own promotion?
No, I did not. I didn't. It was not necessarily the plan. It just kind of, I guess it was meant to be, because it just kind of all fell together. You know, I was here in Louisville, Kentucky. And at the time I got to be honest, I was getting a little frustrated with wrestling, with the business in itself, that there were no standards anymore as far as training or development of the next generation of wrestlers. Mm-hmm. And because, you know, to be quite honest, I was, I'd go to an independent show, and I'm not, you know, we know aesthetically, cosmetically, because the wrestling business is an aesthetic business. You know, we need to be able to, you know, portray that we're prize fighters the minute we walk through the curtain, you know? So I'm not even going to get into the aesthetic part, but there are so many people now that are in the wrestling business that physically they are just not in the proper condition to perform safely and respectfully, both for themselves and for their opponent. I mean, I watch these young men and women are in the ring and they're so blown up in 6-7 minutes. And now they're going to try to do that big high spot that they saw on Raw this week. And
hey, it took 15 years for me to blow up in 6 minutes. But I finally accomplished the fact. So this really, what you're answering now, it kind of leads me into my next question, the state of the wrestling business today.
Yeah.
And you were kind of describing it. So continue.
Well, you know, you remember back in the day, it was very difficult to get in the business. It was, I tell people all the time and they think I'm kidding, but it's easier to be a made man in the mafia than it was to become a professional wrestler a lot of times. Mm-hmm. And a large part of that was because, you know, people were held accountable for whoever they taught or trained, whoever they brought in the business. That's gone away. And, you know, I was talking to my wife, and she's a licensed masseuse. And I was talking about, you know, the regulations and all these things that she had to go through to get to be a licensed masseuse. And I thought, you know, it's absurd. It's insulting. Quite honestly, we have wrestling commissions around the country. And if you want to be a licensed barber, you want to be a licensed hairstylist,
anything.
You want to be a licensed mortician. You've got to go to a state accredited school. You've got to be taught by a state accredited teacher. You've got to complete a certain number of required hours of training. Then you've got to have a certain amount of residency training, which is where your supervised experience. Then you get to take a test and get a license. If you in any state that has a commission, whether it's Missouri, Louisiana, Alabama, South Carolina, Kentucky, you go to any one of those states and you want to be a wrestler, all you got to do is.
So Kentucky still has an athletic commission or a wrestling commission?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, really? Definitely. Oh, yeah.
They got rid of it at one time, I know.
They did, and then because of nonsense and shenanigans, it was brought back. And and you know, but the only requirement you have to be a professional wrestler is you got to just take a physical.
Yeah,
and I thought that was insulting. So I went to the board of directors. You know, I'd approached Maryland and a couple other commissions, and I was like, why don't you develop a training license? Have a certain number of required hours, have the people that train have to pass a certain standards test, you know, so that you can up the quality of what's being trained out there.
Mm-hmm.
They just kind of blew me off.
Oh, yeah.
And at the time I was hanging out in OVW with Danny, and Danny got to talking, and he was ready to retire, and one thing led to another. And, you know, I ended
Danny,
up buying
OVW. Danny Davis.
Danny Davis, yeah. And myself and I had two partners at that time. We bought Danny out and bought OVW in 2018. And, you know, I started trying to raise the standards back up. We're the only Dutch, we're the only training facility in the world where we're accredited by the State Office of Proprietary Education in the state of Kentucky as a trade school for professional wrestling, sports entertainment, and broadcasting.
Wow. No one else. Congratulations. Yeah.
Thank you. Took about 2.5-3 years to get it.
No kidding.
Yeah. But we were able to get, you know, a designation as an actual accredited trade school. And
wow. Do you have diplomas?
You have certificates of completion because it's a trade school. It's not a university or a so it'd be no different than like a beauty college or so
you know where this is going, James. I have a university, Al.
Oh, do
it's
you?
Called the University of Dutch. And just for yeah. you, I have
yes.
I gotta show it to you. Oh, the University of Dutch. That is available, by the way.
Yes.
But that's actually a good looking diploma. I'll make you one.
I'll make you one
and
please.
Send it to you. And I'll make one for your school and just copy
yes.
it. And you got it.
So that would be awesome.
It's like somebody says, you know so much about wrestling. Where did you get your education from? And they can say, I got mine from the University of Dutch. What would you call your school? What would you call your university or college?
It's OVW Academy.
See? And that would look really, really good right there.
That would. I will put it up in the office. That's for sure.
So, Al, let me ask you, where are you from?
Originally, I'm from Lima, Ohio, little town in northwest Ohio.
I remember riding up and down the road with you, and we were talking about Lima, and we would just go on and on and on and on. The bullshit never stopped.
Oh, never.
That's why the trips were short. They could be long, but the bullshit could have been so good that you didn't mind it.
When we were riding with Barry Horowitz and you would just torture him. Remember this was back when we still had payphones, and remember Barry always had to call home at a certain time on the road. Didn't matter where we were at.
Yeah.
We'd have to stop at a gas station. And that one night he was in the payphone booth and Bradshaw pulled the car up and blocked the doors with the bumper and started hitting the horn.
Barry
went
that.
Nuts in the payphone booth, just yelling and screaming.
Oh, those were fun times though.
Oh,
I mean, it was interesting, and it was a rib that didn't hurt anybody. It was but it just upset Barry. Of course, we took delight in that, and he knew we were kidding, so it wasn't really mean to him. So,
no, not at all.
Okay, Lima is in the state of Ohio, whose big claim to fame in the wrestling business was the Sheik.
The original
Sheik. Well known. Did you ever wrestle the Sheik?
I never did wrestle him. I worked on some of his shows when he was at the back end of his, you know, his company was kind of in the downturn, you know, and his career was coming to an end. I remember, though, I was so scared of him as a kid, you know, that when I was in the locker room and he walked in, I'd like freeze, you know, because I still was like terrified of him.
So he was that scary?
Oh, yeah, yeah. He was believable, you know.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, he was terrifying.
Wow. I've heard.
Yeah.
Now, the Sheik had a territory based out of Detroit, correct?
Correct. Yeah, yeah. The main office.
And they did big business at one time.
Yeah, the Ohio-Michigan territory was always historically a really big money territory, even back during the days in the 40s and in the 30s, because not many other states, like, there are major population centers. Toledo is literally 2 hours north of Dayton, Ohio. It's an hour south of Detroit, you know, but it's a major population center. Dayton is a major population center that's an hour and a half away from Cincinnati, straight down I-75. Cincinnati is an hour and a half from Columbus, which is another major population center. And then Columbus is an hour and a half from Cleveland, which is another major population center. And then Canton, Youngstown is a major population center. And then Akron. So you've got all those major cities where there are, you know, you can draw huge audiences. And the same goes for Michigan. You had Detroit, you had Saginaw, you had, you know, all these large cities. And it was in the Rust Belt, in the automotive, where the automotive industry was really big. you know, and Sheik made a lot of money for a lot of years there running that territory.
Well, how, let me bring this up. Did you ask the Sheik how to get in the business, or how did you get in the business? Or did you have the nerve to even approach the Sheik?
Oh, no way. No, no. When I was 14, I decided I wanted to be in the business. So I would walk to the local, because we didn't have Google or any of that stuff back then. So I walked to the public library. I would get the Bill Apter magazines and religiously. And then I would, I'd see that Crockett's promotion was in Charlotte, North Carolina. You know, Sheik's was in Detroit, Michigan. Vern Gagne's was, the AWA was in Minneapolis, Minnesota. So they had the white pages for each one of those major cities at the library. So I would go, and I'd go down and find AWA. I'd find Crockett Promotions.
And how old were you?
14. I'd write the number down. I'd walk back home. And then once a month, I would call, I'd go down the list, and I'd call every one of them once a month, asking them to train me. And then they got to the point where they would recognize, you know, some of the office people would recognize me and either hang the phone up, or they'd leave me on hold, or they'd get bored and they'd talk to me and rib me and mess around with me. And
so who did train you?
Well, a guy by the name of Jim Lancaster.
I know him.
Yep.
He's passed away now, business. Right?
No, he's still alive. He's still alive. He was coming out, he had just had his daughter, and he wanted to kind of semi-retire and run his own shows. And I went to him at first, and I asked him to, you know, if he'd train me, and he told me no. He's like, yeah, go check with Al Costello. Al's up in Detroit. He's training some guys. And I happened to get a hold of Gene Anderson in Crockett's office before I met Jim. And Gene told me that in a couple months, they were going to have a tryout. It was $250 to try out. You know, you can come down to Charlotte.
And you were still 14 or 15?
I was 18 now.
Okay.
I was 18. So I saved up my money, and I drove down to, you know, took the Greyhound bus, which is cool.
What year was this?
1981.
Now, $250
was a lot of money.
It's like $1,000 or $1,200 now. Yes or no?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So you saved your money. You went down.
I went down.
What happened?
Well, show up Sunday morning, right? You know, you're going to have the house show that night.
Were you excited?
I was excited. I was scared. I was wired up like a crackhead. I was ready to go. And Gene was there, and there were maybe 30, 40 other guys. And he comes over, and I give him his money, and he gives me this release. Sign it, kid. So I sign it. He's the only one there, so it says hold harmless. So I write Gene Anderson in there, you know. And we go out, we get our workout gear on. About 30, 40 of us. And here comes Ole Anderson.
Ole's got five.
Yeah, he's got five guys he's already training, right? So then they basically, you know what they did. They're going to blow you up so they can manhandle you in the ring. They'll stretch you, send you home. Well, they made it. I tell people all the time what we went through, and they're like, there's no way. I'm like, yeah, that's exactly what we did. Remember how in the back parking lot, I'll never forget that back parking lot kind of went over across and kind of went up a hill, then went up a little more of a hill and then came down. Yep. I know that because we ran 5 miles around that damn thing that day to warm up. Now we go back inside. We do 500 squats. Once we get 500 squats done, we got to go run up in between the seats and back
down. How many guys threw up?
Oh, lots. Bunches of them.
But not you.
Were starting, well, I didn't know. Surprisingly, I didn't. guys started dropping pretty quick, you know. The 5 mile run took 12 or 15 of them off the map real fast. Then the stairs took more off, and then we came down and we had to do 400 push-ups. Didn't matter how you got them done, you had to do them. And then if it wasn't your turn to go in the ring, you had to stand there and do jumping jacks. Then you had to put some on your back, run to the end of the arena and back. That's some big fat bastard. And then you get in the ring, you know, and Ole's in there, and he immediately comes up and just starts yelling in my face. And I'm like 18-year-old kid, you know.
He scared you.
Oh, terrified, man. Yeah. I couldn't, you know, and Lancaster had worked for Crockett and knew Ole, and he said, I'll tell him I said hi. So like an idiot, I go, Jim Lancaster's real legal name is Jim Painter. So I go, oh, Jim Painter says hi. He goes, I don't know, no goddamn Jim Painter. Get in, shut up, get down on the mat. So I'm like, well, that didn't work. So I got to get in all fours in the amateur position. And then he's teaching the guys how to belly out a guy, right behind their leg and rear chin lock, right? He's stretching them. He's stretching everybody. So somehow, Dutch, to this day, I don't know how, but I made it through four of them. I finally get to the fifth guy. You know, the guy gets me, and I can't get up. I just can't get away, and Ole's screaming in my face to give up. I probably would have, but my jaw was clamped shut because the guy had me in a rear chin lock. I couldn't talk. So he says, do it again. So I almost get away. Ole gets mad. Now, at this point, you're completely exhausted, right? Intimidated. Ole usually gets in the ring with you, and then he hooks you. He usually, you know, sugars you or something and stretches you. And but I had wrote Gene's name on the release. So I have to get back down on all fours. Gene gets in, and we go at it. He starts fish hooking me, pulling my, you know, digging in my mouth, pulling my hair. And I'm like, what is going on? This guy is just going after me like an animal. And so I start struggling. And at, you know, at some point he tries to grab my nuts. I grab his, I keep a hold of him. He rolls me over, puts his,
now that's the story.
Yeah. Smashes my nose in the bottom cable of the rope, you know, cause it's just an aircraft, broke my nose, and I'm holding on for dear life. And
he, so Gene got mad at you.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And he put his thumb in my eye, and he's like, do you want to lose an eye, kid? And now Ole becomes the voice of reason. And it's like, oh, just calm down. Everything.
Oh my God.
Blood's pouring out of my face. And Gene kicks me in the ass and kicks me out of the ring. I came back that night and watched the show, watched, you know, Valentine and Piper in a dog collar match. And,
in Charlotte.
Cornodal and, Sergeant Slaughter.
Big crowd.
Sold out house.
This was the time that Charlotte was hot. Very hot.
Yeah.
And they had talent and had great angles.
Yeah.
And that's when they were so hot. So, well, I hate you. I hate you.
Jake Roberts.
Wait a minute. When you train a guy, would you do that?
No. I know why they did it at the time.
Oh, yeah. They blew you up.
They blew you up and they stretch you and then they send you home. And that way you can tell everybody, you know, look, this is what it took just to try to get in. So you can imagine how hard it would be to be in the business. I mean, they were doing it to protect it.
Well, they made a good payday that day.
Oh, yeah.
All those guys paid the same thing, and there was like 20 or 30 of them.
There were, yeah. Yeah, they made a lot of money that day.
So,
all right.
What was the first territory you worked?
I would go out, because, you know, the way, you know, used to, you started as a job guy. You'd go just for TVs to try and get your foot in the door.
And you worked the independents, right?
Well, yeah, the Outlaws back then. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I would, and you could keep pretty busy back then on the Outlaws, you know, cause you know, they run pretty much 5-6 days a week. Mm-hmm. So I'd go out and work for Muchnick in, Missouri and Geigel in Kansas City.
Mm-hmm.
And then, Vern up in Minnesota, George Cannon up in Windsor.
But they weren't independents. They had regular territories, right?
Yeah,
so you were working regular territories then.
Those two, yeah. And then the Bruisers in Indiana, and and then occasionally down for Paphos in Eastern Kentucky, you know.
So
I'd go down there.
Where did I meet you the first time? WWF? I mean,
I think we met before that. I just can't remember when it was or where it was, but I'm pretty confident. I remember meeting you before that. And then we met back up in WWF in 95.
Tell me about your Smoky Mountain days. How did you get there?
Well,
You ought to say lucky, I guess. I was just lucky.
I actually was. Here's the thing. Okay. At that point in time, I'd started in 1982 and it was 1995. And I had been, you know, nobody really took notice of me or anything. And a large reason why was because I didn't have a persona, personality to sell. You know, I was good in the ring, mm-hmm. but, you know, no, you couldn't describe me. And I, at that time, had trained Dan Severin to be a professional wrestler. And then Dan got a chance in the UFC, UFC 4 out in Tulsa. Mm-hmm. And so Dan came to me and he's like, he knew how to wrestle, but he didn't know how to necessarily fight. They're two different things. And so I said, you know, when I look back at it now, we had no idea what we were doing, you know, because the UFC was so different, because literally, number one, you didn't know who you were going to fight at all. Number two, you didn't know, you know, like today, the UFC, the MMA has its own style. There's all fighters have a ground game and they have a stand-up game. Well, back in those days, like Dan's a wrestler, he would face a karate guy. Or like that mm-hmm. night, he had to fight three times. The first fight was a Muay Thai fighter. The second fight was a long style karate fighter. And the third was jiu-jitsu, was Hoist Gracie. So there was no way to prepare or specify or train for a specific opponent, because number one, you didn't know who you were going to face. And number mm-hmm. two, you didn't know what type of style they fought when you did it. So we just did our best. And
so
I ended up being...
What was your record in MMA style?
Well, I didn't.
You didn't
fight
have
in, no. I went and fought over in.
You know what
Japan
my record was?
What's that?
0-0.
It's zero.
Because I put James read me something earlier. Said favorite holes. I said any that don't hurt. That was my favorite hole. Yeah. So, but you know, those MMA guys, they got to be just a different mindset.
They're a different breed.
They're nuts.
Definitely. Dan was a different breed too, you know. But what got me the opportunity in Smoky Mountain was I was his Dan's corner man. And mm-hmm. Jimmy was watching the pay-per-view. I'd known Jimmy since probably 84 mm-hmm. at that time, you know. And I would reach out to Jimmy, and Jimmy never really had an opportunity for me in Smoky Mountain. And the reason why is I just didn't have a personality he felt that he could sell. And that night, for whatever reason, the guy comes over to interview Dan after a second fight. And, you know, you just beat this guy. What are you going to do now to prepare for Hoist Gracie? You know, he's trying to get Dan to put Hoist over, because the whole thing was the Gracie family. Mm-hmm. And Dan didn't say anything. And I was like, well, what do you think he's going to do? He's going to go back in the locker room and have sex. And I'm just being a smart ass. And Jimmy saw that and was so taken with me being such a smart aleck that he Eddie Gilbert was supposed to be Glenn Jacobs, Kane's partner in Smoky Mountain. And he wanted a guy that would basically run his mouth and start the fight and then Glenn mm-hmm. stop it. And Eddie had left to go to Puerto Rico because he had gotten an opportunity to have the book there, to be the booker. And Jimmy needed a replacement. And he, after he saw me on UFC, he felt that I could do it.
Well, about him going to Puerto Rico, I actually booked him in Puerto Rico, but yeah. It was before I left, because right. I brought him in down there and I heard that he had just walked out on Smoky Mountain yeah. and he went down there and, well, hell, I had him there then. I don't know what I'm supposed to do. And then guess what? He walked out on me.
Did he
and
really?
And he went somewhere. And then to tell the story, I left. And then Carla said, who do I get to be the booker? What do you think about Eddie Gilbert? And I said, well, I think he might fit. But I knew Eddie's ways. And yeah. he said, well, you call him. I said, no, I'm not calling him. Because I told you that, you know, if somebody has a substance abuse problem, right. Puerto Rico was the last place you wanted them to be. And I said, you can call him. I'm not calling him. So Carlos called him, set it up. And I think about 2 months later, they found him in his room. He's
dead. Yeah.
But they said he had a heart attack, but I think he may have had a little help with that. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. But so when you got to Smoky Mountain, what happened?
Yeah. The very first day I came in and I hadn't been on TV in years. So I went out, you know, worked with George South. I love George South. What an underrated, underappreciated, talented guy that guy is. Seriously. I could tell so many great moments with George in the ring, and Jesus, so easy. Every time's a night off. So I work with George. I spend most of the time being a heel, you know, just working the crowd like it's a house show. And then I beat George in like 40 seconds.
Yeah.
And then I'm heading over to, you know, JR, who's doing because I'm going to cut a promo. Mm-hmm. And apparently Jimmy's in the back throwing desks, screaming, because I didn't do it, you know. So when I walk back through, Jimmy is all calm and he's like, hey, that was good, but could you go back out and do it again? Just work with George one more time, show what you can do. I go, okay. And then I go back in and I beat him in about 30 seconds again. Jimmy,
what was the finish supposed to be?
It was the fact that I didn't do enough on, you know, for a TV match. It wasn't enough action. It was just, I went in, I'd talk a lot of BS, and then I just beat him like quick, you know. And there was no specific finish. It was the fact that, you know, I explained that today. I'm like, it's a TV audience. They have nothing invested. If you don't give them something to keep their interest, they're going to turn the channel. So I didn't know that at that time. And
that would have been Jimmy a good thing to know before that match.
Yeah. It would have been. Yeah. But, you know, this business is not a very verbal business that people, you know, the guys don't really go pull you aside and go, hey, you need to know this, 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 this. They just figure you do. And then when you don't, they try and fix it.
Let's go with a little history here. So when you went to Smoky Mountain, Ricky Morton had just left.
Ricky was still there.
Oh, he was still there. So why did Ricky left though, right? Or he did? Didn't he walk out or something? Or
I think that was toward the end. Yeah, when I was gone. After I'd went to WWF, I think Ricky then walked out at that point. You know.
But at one point, weren't you and Unabomber without opponents?
No, Jimmy had done an angle where I had took Ricky out, you know, in a Johnson City in a cage match. I had suggested an idea I'd seen when the Samoan SWAT team had done something down in down the old Fuller territory in Pensacola, and that where they came up from the underneath of the ring. So if you remember Big Sam, he was part of the South African Truth Commission.
I sure do.
He physically looked like Glenn, and Glenn used to wear that hockey mask in that cave. So we literally put in Johnson City, we put, you know, handcuffed Robert to one side of the cage, handcuffed what was to be Glenn, but it was Sam, to the other side of the cage, and then put Glenn underneath. And then we just moved the boards out of the way, sliced open the canvas, and Glenn came up inside the cage and we laid out Ricky, you know.
Oh, that was good for Johnson City.
Yeah. Yeah.
They'd never seen something like that. Was New Jack there?
Oh yeah,
how was he to be around? I only met him a time or two. I heard a lot of stories about him.
Yeah, and they're probably all true.
Probably
he was always, you know, respectful to me. He was charming. He was funny, but then, you know, there was that other side of him that he was basically a sociopath. You know, he was, you know. He'd create these situations and create drama, and, you know, and you just knew that if you were to ever go sideways with him, you're probably going to have to kill him or something.
Do you remember when he threw the guy off the cage?
Oh, it was off the scaffolding.
Almost killed himself. Vic Venom was his name.
Vic Grimes. Yeah. Yeah. He tasered.
What was that about?
It was something that Vic had accidentally done to Jack and had injured Jack in a match months prior. And then, you know, Jack fully went up there fully with the plan to, you know, try to hurt Vic. and tasered him and then tossed him off the thing head first. You know, Vic almost died, you know.
No kidding.
Yeah.
He just got lucky. So when he threw him, what did he hit first? He hit the turnbuckle or what? Ropes
I think he bounced off, because it was a bunch of tables stacked up or something. And he hit off of those. And then he hit the top rope and then rebounded off of that and against the ring apron and onto the floor.
That's crazy.
It was ugly. I mean, it was really scary.
And where was that? Where did that happen at?
ECW.
Wow, that's crazy. So let me, James just showed me a picture here.
Uh-huh.
And you're friends with Marty Jannetty.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I love Marty.
Okay, he's in the hospital now, or he's injured?
That all started, Dutch, when Marty and I were partners. And it was right near the end of Marty was about to leave WWF. He was going to WCW. And he rolled his ankle really severely. And he just, you know, back then, remember, we'd go out for, like, I'd explain to people, like, we'd go out for 8 to 10, 12, 14 days in a row. Remember when Ross, JR came to everybody and was like, hey, boys, we're only going to work you 21 days a month, you know?
Yeah.
He didn't tell you that sometimes that might be all 21 right in a row.
And they even went past that at times.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I tell the story. I hit 60 days without going home in a row.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think back on what I was making, they wouldn't pay me nothing. Yeah. I was just staying busy.
Yeah, business wasn't really good back then either. I mean, remember when we celebrated, we got a $100,000 house and we celebrated. It was like, oh my God,
yeah.
That's
Oh, yeah,
that's
I amazing. Remember that. Okay, and, so Marty's in a hospital about his ankle. Have you seen the picture? Yeah.
It's horrible.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
James showed it to me earlier. I could not believe it when I saw it.
He, that was when we were partners, he rolled his ankle, kept working on it and never went to the doctor or anything. And then just kept working on it for years. And then, he went in for a surgery and got it repaired finally, and then contracted some kind of infection, and the infection's in the bone. And they can't seem to get rid of it. And I saw the photo of his foot and his ankle, and it looks horrendous. It looks like a science project.
Oh, it does. I'm looking at it, and I said, James, why did you show me this picture? Because I'm squeamish. I'm squeamish anyway.
Yeah.
So, but I hope he's okay. I like so Marty. Too. Marty, he has his size like everybody else, but when you get hurt like that, I hope him the best.
Yeah, I don't think Marty gets the credit that he really deserves to just how good he really was, and how much of a factor he was, and he gets overshadowed by Sean, I think.
A lot.
And I think people don't really appreciate just how really, really good he really was.
I
say that all the time.
You got to know Marty very well when you took Sean's place, right?
Yes.
And you have and what was that team called?
The New Rockers.
Okay.
Cornette always says that, if you want the death of anything, put New in front of it right out of the gate. So
Jimmy is always so encouraging. He really is. So when you got to WWF, did you find the drug culture to be kind of out of control, the pill culture?
It was pretty heavy, and it seemed like it got heavier the longer I was there. When I first came in, you'd see a few people and it wasn't so open and out. But then as time went by, it seemed like it started to get worse. And guys would, would just be like that in front of everybody.
Do you remember the trip, the European trip that we made, and I think you were on this. I'm pretty sure you were on this. That we got to London, and they had wrecked the first class cabin. They'd had a food fight. Knife was sticking into the wall. They were.
Oh, that was when we went to Kuwait. That was when we went to Kuwait, and we literally
kicked us off the plane.
Yes, I remember they kicked us off the plane. Then the other one was when we went to Kuwait. And we were going to do a layover, stopover in Amsterdam, And they were threatening to kick us off the plane there too, because the boys up in, you know, business class, first class, started going crazy.
And that's nuts.
You know, that is nuts. I remember Davey, and this was when they used to have real cutlery, and he threw one of the knives stuck in the wall, and it stuck in the wall. Yeah, in the plane. Yeah,
I think I'm pretty sure, because I didn't go to Kuwait. I'm pretty sure we were going to Germany. They did kick us off the plane. We had to get another airline to finish taking us to Munich, Germany, or wherever we were going. And they had to call the office, and the office was all upset. What's wrong with the friggin' guys and whatever. And Savio Vega, I had him on not too long ago. He was a major cause of it, him and Razor.
Yeah,
and I was telling James a little earlier, we had this match, you against Bradshaw.
I remember.
I remember he hit you with a clothesline.
Yes.
And the next thing I heard, I'm standing outside the ring, was, Jesus fucking Christ. Do I owe you money or something like that? And I didn't want to laugh, but I had to laugh. And you looked at me and you said, what's the fuck wrong with him? I'm out there saying, I'm begging off. I'm going, I didn't have anything to do with it. I swear.
Yeah. And then in the locker room, because I had ran over and bumped you off the ring apron, you were like, oh, you were so stiff. I'm like, tell your boy, he's the one who's stiff, not me.
Oh, I was kidding you. I don't mind that stuff, but he did hit you. And
he did.
And you don't expect to hear, Jesus fucking Christ. And you hold your throat like, hey, damn, you amputated my head. Or,
yeah, he dropped the elbow on me right after that. And I started cussing more.
It's crazy. But how did your run in Smoky Mountain go?
It went good. I mean, it was, I was really lucky. I got to work with, you know, Tony Anthony and Tracy Smothers, and
it was a lot with
Ricky and Robert.
It was a good territory.
I got to sit with Buddy Landell. That's another guy too. I don't think Buddy gets the credit for just how really talented he was. I mean, he was so,
and we've talked about this on this show before. He was so talented. Mm-hmm. He didn't go to Atlanta TV one day.
Yeah.
He missed it. And the next week or 2 weeks later, they were going to put the title on him.
I remember.
And he just missed the TV. And the next thing I know, he was up there in Memphis with me, making the trips where he could have been the NWA heavyweight champion. And I'm thinking, my God, buddy, how silly must you be? And when he passed away, I really felt bad. Because Buddy, he had a bad drug problem.
He did.
But he had a heart of gold. He was a really, really good guy.
And I remember
and he couldn't get rid of the demons. The demons had him, and he couldn't get rid of those demons.
I learned a lot from Buddy, being around him and just listening to him.
Is he funny?
Oh, my God. Do you remember? There was a night, right? We're in Ashland, Kentucky. Okay. Remember Sandy Scott?
You need some laughs being in Ashland, Kentucky.
Yeah.
Need something to make you feel better.
Remember Sandy Scott, right? Remember he was the road manager. Yeah. So we're in Ashland, right? And Buddy is in the ring working with Dirty Boy Tony Anthony, right? And a fan jumps up on the ring apron, and Buddy spins around, sees him, and throws a working punch. He slaps his chest and throws a working punch, and the fan, like, and sees his fist and kind of goes and freezes, like, did he hit me? I heard it, right? And everybody in the whole building went quiet as the fan didn't fall. The fan then goes like, hey, I didn't get hit. He goes to go in the ring, and here comes Sandy from the front of the building running all the way back. Because Sandy's 50-some years, you know, almost 60 years old, tackles the guy off the ring apron and starts hitting him and going, that's the way you throw a goddamn working punch, buddy. boom, and he just keeps pounding him. And the cops come and take him away. Well, the next day we're in, I don't know where it was, in West Virginia. Buddy walks in and his elbow's all swollen up, where he had hyperextended his elbow throwing that working punch on the fan.
So he got hurt throwing his own punch.
Yes, yes.
Oh, my God.
The fan never got touched.
This is a thing that's never been explained to me, and I want you to do it for me. Mm. Where did the head gimmick come from? I loved that gimmick. I loved it.
When I was in
you talked to the head and everything, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So when I was in WWF, I was Leaf Cassidy, and then I left because I knew I had to leave. I had to go someplace else. They put me on loan to ECW, and I knew I had to get over there. So, but there were fans that knew me as Al Snow, and I knew there were WWF fans that knew me as Leaf Cassidy. And I thought, well, you know, if anybody at that time, I'd been working for maybe 14, 15 years. And I thought, anybody been working that long at something and not, you know, things aren't turning out the way they are, at some point I'm probably going to have a nervous breakdown. And if I'm Leaf Cassidy,
a nervous breakdown. Hey, that would be good. That was a good idea. So that's okay. Go ahead.
Anybody that happy, if you're Leaf Cassidy, has to be mentally unstable. You know what I mean? So, I literally started reading books on abnormal psychology, and I read this case study that about a woman. She was schizophrenic, and she had what they call transference disorder. So she would hear
what was it?
Voices. Transference disorder. She'd transfer her illness onto the objects she heard the voices from.
I like it already.
So I found a styrofoam head in the back, and I thought, you know, I'm going to take this to the ring with me and treat it like it's a real person. And then it started getting over, and Spike Dudley and Mikey Whipwreck found the beautician's head in a barrel that the fans would bring weapons for New Jack to use, and they gave it to me. Said, here you go. Here's a real head for you to use. And it just took off from there.
There were so many things you could do with it.
Oh, yeah.
And if the people thought you were nuts, which they only had to watch you a little bit to figure out, they would think that you were legitimately kind of off. And you talked ahead, and there were so many things that you could do with that. And you weren't limited.
No.
I mean, when you're a cowboy, you're kind of limited to doing cowboy stuff. But that opened all the doors for you.
Yeah,
all of them.
Yeah. A lot of people, you know, claim like, you know, I was a comedian wrestler or whatever. And I wasn't a comedian at all. I was an entertaining wrestler. But the reason that it was funny was I didn't do it for laughs. I did it because I was supposed to be insane, which meant I could get away with anything, you know,
anything
at all. And, you know, I say what they want, but I was on TV a lot during that run. I mean,
it got over.
I was on TV on Mondays when we had SmackDown on Tuesdays. We did Sunday Night Heat. We did Saturday Night Velocity. I was on every one of those shows every single week doing something. You know,
see, that's basically a writer's dream.
Yeah.
That's what you had, because it was easy to write. Yeah. It was easy because you could just let go and talk about what you wanted to do with a gimmick like head.
Yeah.
I mean, I would have loved to have it, because I would have done a lot more with it. So, okay, in ECW.
Yeah.
Weren't you supposed to have a match with Shane Douglas? For the title, or you did?
I did. And and Paulie, you know, had this idea. He was like, oh, everybody's going to assume that you're going to win. And I think we need to keep the belt on Shane. And Shane was a mess. Shane had a broken arm. He had sinus and all. His nose was all broken and everything. And I just, you know, at that time I had re-signed with WWF. I was on my way out anyways.
Yeah.
And you know, we went and worked in Georgia at the pay-per-view, headlined the pay-per-view, and I put Shane over.
Where was the pay-per-view in Atlanta?
Just Marietta? Outside of Atlanta. Yeah, I think it was like Marietta.
Where they used to do WCW TV.
Yeah.
I remember the building.
Yeah. And I remember talking about this with Terry Taylor, and Terry was like, man, they, you know, you know, and this isn't me, this isn't my opinion, but Terry and a lot of other people said that, you know, Paul made a big mistake. They should have just, everybody wanted me to win the title. He said they should have let me win the title. And then the very next week at TV, let Taz take it off me, you know, if I'm
leaving. That's what I would have done.
Yeah, but Paul wanted to keep it on.
Yeah, well, Shane, he owns a company, so I understand that.
Yeah.
What are you over? Sorry, Dutch. I want to continue on that briefly. Do you think if you not sign with the WWF, but if WWF had let you stay in ECW a bit longer, would the plans have changed and you would have been the champ?
No, I don't think so. The reason that I did resign, Vince Russo reached out to me, months prior about wanting, you know, he had seen what I was doing and he had talked to Vince McMahon and wanted to bring me back. And I was like, nope, I'm fine right where I'm at, Vince. You know, I'm happy. And then a couple weeks go by, and I think Dutch can corroborate this for me.
Oh, but, I didn't take the oath you did. You have to tell the truth. I'll tell a bunch of lies here.
Well, I'm at Jerry Lynn's house. We're doing a run in Florida, like a 4-day run in Florida. And I'm in Orlando and I'm at Jerry Lynn's house and I'm watching the opening of the television show. They made a new opening of the television show, the ECW show. Okay. And I'm not bragging. I'm not, you know, at that time I was pretty much one of the most over guys in the company.
I think he is starting to brag here a little bit. go ahead.
Well, And I think you'll attest to this, Dutch, the people you want to sell, that you want to highlight, you put on that opening reel, you know, highlight reel. I was nowhere on it. Nowhere. Nothing. And I was like, that is not a good sign. That shows what my plan, what your plans were.
Yep.
So I picked up the phone that same night. I called Vince Russo. I said, and that was when we were still could send a VHS tape. I said, Vince, I'll send you a VHS tape. He goes, all right. I sent the VHS tape, and like, you know, a week or two later, Vince McMahon called me, and you know, I re-signed to go back with WWE.
Did who came up with the idea of all the styrofoam heads in the crowd?
It was kind of a group thing. It was Paul. It was me. It was, you know, and then Paul. You know, Paul wanted it to look like. It was a rave, you know, like a party whenever I came out, and Charlie and Ron, the camera guys, they were the ones that would turn the camera upside down and push it in and out. They came up with all of that, you know, and it worked. I mean, it was a great run. That's for sure. It was a lot of fun. So,
well, it was easy to work with. I know that.
And then the thing that got me over the most in ECW was not the wrestling. I tell people this all the time. I'd gotten hurt. I'd worked with Paul. I always forget his name. Thunder Bay, Ontario, Canada. Paul. He was with.
Paul.
He was with the Orient Express. Wait a minute.
I have no idea.
I always forget his name. But we worked in the arena, and Paul Heyman was. It just came to me, and he was going to, I could tell he finally was starting to get behind the head gimmick. He was wanting me to come out and save Sandman, you know, and have Sandman's t-shirt wrapped around the head or whatever, try and give me the rub from Sandman. And that night, Paul went to give me a gourd buster. My arm got caught up underneath me, and it completely dislocated my shoulder. And like, it was 2 weeks out from the pay-per-view, from the November to Remember pay-per-view. Paul was, you know, going to have me work on the pay-per-view, but unfortunately I gotten hurt. So he put me in Chris Candido, God bless his heart, politicked and got me a backstage vignette where I'm talking to the head and everything else is normal. And the next day, that was the one thing everyone talked about, was that vignette. So if I'd have gotten a chance to wrestle, I honestly don't think I'd have gotten over near like I had by just simply being backstage and doing that vignette. And that was what really got it over, what really sold the character.
Okay, Chris Candido in those days. What year was this? This was before he went to Puerto Rico.
I remember when he went to Puerto Rico. I remember when he went to Puerto Rico. He had went he was in WWF, had left and went to ECW. And he was kind of Paul's right-hand man at that time in ECW.
Okay, Puerto Rico was after that because he talked about Paul a lot. Was Tammy with him?
Yeah, she had come along after that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
She wasn't there initially with Chris in ECW, and then she got released.
What's the most fun you've had in the wrestling business? I mean, we talk about the bad times, the long trips, sometimes not getting paid. Tell me about the fun times you had. Of course, a lot of them were with me, but I'll just let that slide right now.
Remember the night in Germany we went in that adult bookstore, and the deal was you, me, Barry, and Brian Shaw, and Glenn Jacobs, and let's go find the weirdest video and then get everybody else. And I came out of the video booth.
You were throwing up.
I was throwing up, dry even, because I saw a German Schweitzer video. And then you guys had me tell Jerry Briscoe on the bus the next day, so he started throwing up too.
What was in that video?
I can't even, you know.
It was horrific because
it traumatized me. It did.
Al came out and he's going. I said, "What? And man, you got it." He couldn't even tell me. And
just thinking about it makes me want to dry heave again. I swear to God.
So
it's bad.
Listen,
it's so bad.
And that was the most fun he's ever. That was the most fun he's ever had is when he went into the porn store. So
remember, we went to the red light district and saw a couple live sex shows.
Well,
sitting in the audience doing that.
I actually enjoyed that because I finally learned where the red light name comes from.
Yeah,
you've been there, right, James? In Germany,
I've never been to the light thing. I've been to strip club, but I've never seen live shitting.
They had these huge red doors, right?
Yeah.
They were like 10 foot high, but it was blocking a street. And they had them on the end of this block and the end of this block, like a gate. And you open these big red gates. They were huge. And you walk in, and that's where they had all the strip clubs.
And all the prostitutes.
Yep. But that was interesting. And we went down. People, if you've never been, I'm talking to the guys right now. They have storefront windows.
Yep.
Yes. And the girls sit in the windows. Yep. And who did we have with us?
It was me, you, Glenn Jacobs.
Harvey Whippelstein with us or no?
I think the pug, Alex Porteau, came along with us. And and Mick had joined us at one point too.
Well, I forgot who was with us, but he pointed to a girl like you, me. I swear to God, the girl got up and just left.
Yeah.
She actually quit for that shift. She didn't want to have nothing to do with the guys. She basically just turned him down in public. And I forgot who it was, but do you recall anything like that, or did I make that up?
No, I don't remember.
And we ribbed him. You said, "Damn, it's pretty bad."
It's pretty bad when the prostitute
rejects you. Hope you don't have any prostitute rejection feelings going on this trip because we can't straighten you out.
Yeah,
the job squad.
Yeah,
tell me about that.
It was a joke I had started when I was in WWF the first time. They were doing a big angle with, remember, they had the Los Boricuas, they had BSK. Everybody had a gang, you know what I mean? The Clique. Everybody had a gang on TV and everybody had a gang backstage. And because the locker room was so divided at that point because of the Clique, everybody had a lot of heat back then. And I told Jimmy one time we were sitting in catering
Undertaker's Clique was known as what?
BSK.
Okay.
Bone Crusher Street Crew.
Okay.
And then there were the Cowboys, Dustin, the Smoking Guns, and everybody had a group, you know,
mm-hmm.
and except for us, we were just like the group of misfit toys.
And on the bus in Germany, it was sectioned off too, right?
Oh yeah, it was. Yeah, it was.
The middle
yeah.
of the bus, that's where the bathroom is, or the latrine. All the second squad or the second team guys sat up front.
Yep.
And all the guys in the clique sat in the back. I'll come back to that in a minute. But the bus was, it was separated too.
It was segregated.
We were discriminated against.
Yeah.
Is it too late to sue, James?
The statute of limitations is 24 years.
Okay. Well, we're past that. But go ahead. So where were you?
I was in the catering and I was being a smart ass. And I told Jimmy, I said, I'm going to start my own gang. Jimmy's like, what are you talking about? I said, I'm going to start my own gang. It's going to be me, Barry Horowitz, Candido, Aldo Montoya, all the underneath guys. And we're going to be the most powerful gang there is. And he's like, how are you going to be the most powerful gang? I said, we're the job squad. You got to wipe the mat with us.
Yeah.
And he goes, how is Barry yourself going to have power? I go, if Undertaker goes out there tonight and he tombstones Barry and Barry stands up and dusts off his hair and walks out, who had the power in that match?
Yeah.
I said, so there were a lot of the boys that really thought they were actually winning. And it was a way to kind of jokingly remind them, you're not really winning because I ain't really losing.
Yeah.
I'm doing you a favor. It's not like you're entitled to it. So don't disrespect me. And it started as a joke. And when I went to ECW, all the boys loved it. And they were like, you need to make t-shirts. So I made t-shirts and I think I sold from March of that year to October of that year. I sold about nearly 4,000 t-shirts at $25 a shirt.
Oh, you got to be kidding me.
No, I'm not. I'm dead
4,000 shirts.
Yes. Yeah.
Damn.
And that was back before the internet commerce was a thing. I only would sell them on the internet and I would sell them at shows.
That would be a collector's item now, right?
Yeah.
A big time.
I sold so many that when I went back to WWF, I signed a licensing agreement for them. And I use this as an example, Dutch, because I tell all the young guys and girls, I'm like, when you get in the ring, the beauty of wrestling is you can do whatever you want once you get in that ring.
Yeah, you're the center.
Your world. You're the center of the universe.
And own it.
You can do whatever you want. Yep, you can own it. But I said, you've got to make a choice. Okay. I use the example. I'm like, Job Squad made me a lot of money. I made, almost 4,000 shirts at $25 a shirt. I said, it was pretty good. I signed a licensing agreement with WWF and it never went anywhere because they did not know how to market the shirts to the casual audience so that where they would understand it and want to buy them.
I was talking about the casual audience just a day or two ago, right, James?
Mm-hmm.
That's when you get a sellout, when the casual fans come, then you have a sellout. Now you know you're doing something right.
And that's what continue. You want to market to. But everyone today always markets to just the wrestling audience. And I'm like, you have the choice. You can be Job Squad, successful, which I was. I made money with those. So you can be Steve Austin successful, whereas his shirts were not just in Hot Topic or Spencer's Gifts in the mall. They were in Elder Beerman. They were in Lazarus. They were in Macy's. They were in Von Braun. They were in Walmart. They were in Target. They were everywhere.
Everywhere.
And he made life-changing money off of those shirts. I said, whereas I made some money, but I didn't make the money. So you can choose to be Stone Cold Steve Austin merchandise successful, or you can choose to be Job Squad merchandise successful.
And that deals
both
in another
successful.
Thing. Yes. You got to take what the market offers and make it count because that's what they give you. This is what I'm going to take.
Right. Yes.
Let me go.
Dutch, can
go,
I?
Go ahead, James.
I do apologize to jump in. I don't want to harp on too much about the Job Squad, but I'm looking. There was five members in total. You, the Blue Meanie, Bob Holly, Dwayne Gill, Gilbert, and Scorpio. Were there any other two questions, actually? One, did you have free reign to a point of who would be in the group? And two, was there anybody that you wanted to join the Job Squad that for whatever reason didn't happen?
No, it was, I think what they were trying to do at the time, and I'm not, again.
He didn't ask me.
Yeah. Well, you were with Bradshaw at the time. and Mick was also going to be a part of it at one point too. And then got changed. Mick Foley.
Yep.
And that got changed. This is all just speculation, but I think a large, they didn't have a direction or an idea to do something with some of those guys. And I think they kind of put them with me to kind of, see if they could manufacture something, because like I tried to explain to Vince Russo, I'm like, I don't know how we're going to do this. The whole idea of this gimmick that was a joke was just to remind people that you're not really winning, so we're not really losing. So how do we put that on TV and sell that to an audience when the rest of the show is all about winning and losing? I said, it makes no sense, Vince, and I don't know how we're going to be able to do it. And it just kind of, as a result, it kind of just floundered. It didn't really go anywhere or do anything because there was no way to really properly use it.
What was the idea to get Mick in? Or was it just a name suggestion and no actual creative to establish why?
Well, it kind of started, and then the following week he was no longer a part of it. So they kind of put him with DX. So I wasn't privy to a lot of the direction or ideas of creative that especially I tell, and this was my fault. I take responsibility, but I would show up. I can't tell you the entire time I was there in WWF, which was my fault. I would literally show up for matches, angles, and no one would ever speak to me and tell me a direction or what they wanted or why I was doing it. The only person that ever really took the time to really, have a conversation with me was Brian Gewirtz. But as far as anyone else, I would literally show up, they'd walk up, oh, you're doing a pre-tape here, you're doing this, you're doing that. I'd be in matches, that would just come out of nowhere. I would be like, I clearly remember one time they had me wear, come out dressed as Vince McMahon, wearing a suit and a rubber mask. And like, I was,
that's entertaining. Vince, I like that.
He's going to ball shot me, but they don't tell me what they want to do with it or why, they don't even talk to me. They just, here you go. And here's what you're doing, and just walk away. And my fault, because I should have asked questions and, all of that, but you just don't at the time. Nobody ever called me ahead of TV and, hey kid, we're thinking about doing this with you this week, and here's what we're hoping to accomplish. And, we're wanting to try and get so-and-so over or try to get heat this way. I could have done whatever their vision was much more effectively if they'd have just communicated more.
But I don't think they knew.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think sometimes they just make it up on the fly.
They knew, and they said, well, the angle is getting over, the character is getting over without anything else. So I think they just let it run and see where they wanted to go with it. But I don't think they knew. But I loved the character. I really did. There were so many things you could do with that character, because, if you weren't limited, that means creative wasn't limited either. And they could do anything with it. Yeah. I don't want to get off this, but I want to ask you, do you remember on the Germany trip?
Yeah.
That all of a sudden Tammy Fitch.
Oh yeah.
Had to leave early. You remember
she
that?
Did. Yeah. I think because the way that whenever we go overseas, one, everyone stayed at the same hotel. Two, the heels went on one bus, baby faces went on another. You were for ground transportation to get between the towns. And then we would always go to the building and we would eat once we got to the building. And then they would make the boxes, food boxes that we could take back to the hotel after the show.
Yep.
And she had had a food box, and it was rumored that one of the clique had placed a rather large turd in the food, then covered
unbeknownst to anybody else.
Unbeknownst to anybody, and then covered it up with noodles that were in, they'd scooped out the noodles and made a little pocket, put the turd in, put the noodles back on, sealed it back up, and then
with her name on top of it.
She came, got it. She and Chris Candido went to the hotel. She was eating the food, got through the noodles, and discovered the very large turd after she'd already eaten several noodles. And No pun intended, shit hit the fan. Yeah.
And we got on the bus that day, and I've yep. told this story before. Very quiet on the bus, wasn't it?
Very quiet. It was
because the clique, they weren't acting up.
No.
Because now they're thinking, oh God, because one of the members was guilty of this, and they were trying to keep it quiet because things spread.
Yep.
And we knew what had happened. And Chris got on the bus, and he was very quiet, right?
Yeah, yeah, it was. And, you know, and Chris was outnumbered. You know, it was a bad spot for Chris. You know,
well, and I've told the story. They were trying to get into the clique.
Mm-hmm.
They spent all that time up there, but what they did, they got up there, and they pissed the clique off.
Yep.
Thus, the payback was the little.
It was
the
a message.
Little noodle. Yeah, the little message was the little noodle box.
Yeah.
And Chris, who had been used to sitting up front, all of a sudden reverted back to sitting with the misfits in the back. So we knew something had happened.
I remember they were in a bad, they had bad attitudes because they were leaving the company after they got back. Remember, then shortly after the return from the tour, they were going to, we were going to Madison Square Garden, and that was their last show. And then they were going to WCW. Remember? And so they already knew they were on their way out of the company. And that was why they were just being such fucking, you know, they were being assholes.
What made you want to become a pro wrestler? It has to go back to your kid days.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, people
you ought to say, oh, I hated those kid days. I hated that crap.
I remember watching it when I was a kid. I remember just getting so, you know, enamored with it. And
if there was independent show close, you would go.
Oh God, yeah, yeah, yeah. You know,
ringside.
If I could find it on TV, any wrestling whatsoever, I could find on TV, I would find it and I would watch it. You know, I bought every magazine. I bought books that I studied. You know, I knew the history of the business. I knew wrestlers in the from the 40s and the 50s and the 30s. Mm-hmm. I was obsessed. You know, I had a poster and had all the NWA world title lineage on it at that time, from Firma Burns on, you know. And I just was completely obsessed. And when I was 14, I made a conscious decision that that was what I was going to do. And I didn't have a plan B. And I've been blessed to be able to do it for 41 years. And, you know, it's been awesome.
So do you deliver you tell this story talking to your students, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And do they have similar experiences? They would just want to be a wrestler.
I don't know, Dutch. I really don't. I think nowadays it's changed. I think two factors. One, I'll give you a good example. Okay. I was doing TV review here in OVW one night, and I was talking about the fact that, you know, I got signed with WWF, and I had been wrestling like 13 years or something at that time. And one of the kids goes, 13 years, you took you 13 years to get signed. I go, yeah. So what? He goes, it's 13 years. And you weren't signed. I go, I didn't get in the wrestling business to get signed with a particular company. I got in the wrestling business to be a wrestler. And that was the big difference. I realized then that was the big difference, because everyone that gets in now, the only reason they get in is to get signed with WWF, period. Mm-hmm. It's all about the destination. It's not about what they're doing. It's about the destination. And, you know, and then if they can't, or they relegate themselves to the belief that they can't get signed with WWF, they just want to be signed by some company. As long as they've signed and they can kind of hold that, you know, look at me, I'm now signed, I'm a step above everybody else, they're thrilled. And that for me wasn't why I got in the business. I wanted to get in the business because I wanted to do this for a living. And I wanted to, my goals were to be able to make a living doing it.
Has AEW reached out to you?
No. We've had some conversations.
Have you sent any of your guys there?
Oh yeah. A lot of guys have went there and worked, you know, dark matches. I've got a tag team called the Outrunners that work on Ring of Honor and AEW quite frequently. And Layla Gray is under contract with AEW. She's still here on a weekly basis as well. So,
has anybody ever contacted you about NXT?
No, never. No.
Yeah, I was watching their product the other day. All their girls are beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
They are. But they all look the same.
Yeah. Well, and they're all very redundant. All the guys, all the girls there.
Yes.
They're very redundant. The matches are very redundant. You know, they're very overproduced. And I think what's missing today is the art of selling, you know, knowing how to sell, knowing what you're selling. All of the talent today sell what they do. They try to convince the audience that the moves are real. And what everyone used to do was convince the audience of who they were was real, and that why they were doing it was real. Sell the audience, because the audience wants to believe in your intent, not in your actions. They want to believe that whatever you're doing, you're trying to do to win and not lose. You sell the consequence of the action that's been done to you. Not that you're hurt, that if it gets done again, you might lose. That's where the real storytelling comes in, and that's where the real drama comes from in a match.
No kidding. I was talking about Bret Hart the other day.
Yeah.
He could sell, but his face never changed.
Never changed. No.
Am I right on that or not?
He was stone-faced.
Yeah, and his face needs to tell the audience.
Tell the story.
I'm in trouble. I'm hurting this guy down near about ready to kill me. But his face never changed. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So I'm watching NXT. Yeah, I'm watching NXT, and I'm saying, wow, this is – I mean, they can do what they want to do.
Oh, yeah.
It's not my physical ability
is amazing.
Okay, this brings up another thing I want to ask you about. The guy they do believe in WWE, they pushed heavy, and they made one of their best choices I think they've made in years is Gunther.
Well, I agree with you, but they're cutting the legs out from underneath him.
What are they doing now?
Well, the way they book certain matches. That guy, Gunther, has the size and was getting over in a way to where you'll understand this, to where he could work programs with guys like Brock Lesnar, Roman Reigns.
All of them.
And that's what they need. But you can't have him work with Sami Zayn and Kevin Owens and go 50-50 with a guy like him. No. You got to have Gunther take 70, they get 30, or 80 and they get 20. Because you want to push him to where he's going to be working. He needs to be a threat for Brock Lesnar. Well, if it's 50-50 with Sami Zayn, how is he going to be where, for the audience, they're going to believe that he's going to be a threat for Brock Lesnar?
Yeah, well, I agree with that. But see,
that's poor booking.
See, I don't watch Raw.
I don't either.
But when I first saw him, I said he's the second coming of Johnny Valentine.
Right, yeah.
Because Valentine went in there, and there was no bullshit to Valentine. There was no performance. And I'm Johnny Valentine, folks. If you don't know who he is, look him up. Because he made believers out of fans that sat at ringside when he would chop Wahoo.
Yeah.
And you could hear it all over the arena. So if you can hear it, you know it had to be laid in pretty hard.
Yeah, but
and Johnny Valentine had a favorite saying, they might think the business might be fake, but they're damn sure know that I'm not.
Right.
And he lived by that. So Gunther, I think if they'd have kept him true to his roots, and it's not too late to go back to it.
No.
But I mean, and you made the right wording that he could work with anybody.
Yeah.
He could work with the heel. And he'd be the baby face, or he could work with the baby face and he'd be the heel, and he wouldn't even have to change at all. So, but I think this is not a podcast about WWE, but it's a podcast about, you know, the way these guys are working now. So in your school, what do you teach?
I teach to sell who and sell why. That's what I teach. I even break up the curriculum in the in-ring wrestling The beginner's course is to teach basic fundamental wrestling, timing, distance, and footwork. You're not going to be hitting the ropes. You're not going to be taking turnbuckles. You're not going to be doing dives. You're going to learn just to wrestle and sell the why, sell the intent. Make me believe that you're using the moves you have to really win a match and trying not to lose. Pinning combinations, escapes, reversals.
Do you do the actual instruction?
I have teachers that I teach to teach the right way. Okay. I have an intermediate class. That's where they start to learn the who. They start to, now they hit the ropes. They take bigger bumps, but they also start learning how to, hey, here's how you're going to communicate being a heel in the match and what you would do and why. Here's how you are as a babyface. And, you know, and then I have the advanced class with Doug Basham. Doug was a former WWE guy. Mm-hmm. And he starts on where now let's start figuring out who you really are and how you can sell that to an audience and in within a wrestling match.
Now you start working with character development, right?
Yeah. And yeah. So I'm trying to teach them not to perform or not to wrestle. I'm trying to teach them to work a wrestling match. So I think that, Dutch, I think that definition has been lost. You know, I don't think people know what that word really means anymore.
What is that?
Work, to work match, you know, to work an audience. I tell them the definition of a work is a con. It's a sham. It's to make an audience believe a lie. And the only lie in wrestling is I'm going out there to really try to win. That's it.
Yes, that's true. If somebody wants that are listening, that wants to be a wrestler, or wants to get into the wrestling business, I want you to tell them how to contact you.
They can go to the website, ovwacademy.com. We are the only accredited as an actual trade school for professional wrestling, sports entertainment, and broadcasting in the world. We don't just teach in-ring wrestling. We also teach camera operation, lighting, sound, event management, financial management, so that when the day comes and you no longer can wrestle in the ring, you'll still have skills that you can now, you know, be a part of the wrestling business and be an addition.
And give that name again, OVW.com?
OVWacademy.com.
OVWacademy.com. Yep. Remember, say it again, people, OVWacademy.com. So if you're interested in wrestling or doing anything, because this is the guy that can show you how. James, give me some questions.
Al, have you got time for one? Have you got time for five?
I got time for a couple more because it's TV day, so I got to hop off here in a few minutes. Otherwise, I'd stay on all day.
Oh, dude, I'd love to have you on all day as well. But there's one thing that Dutch I was hoping would mention and sort of got skipped over in your early days is, until recently, I didn't realize that you had wrestled Bruiser Brody.
Wrestled all those guys.
Oh, you've got to tell me about Brody especially.
Well, you know, I was back during when I would go from different TVs to different TVs, you know, so I was coming in for Vern and, you know, I'm sitting there with my, you know, the guy that I was riding with, and in walks Abdullah the Butcher and Bruiser Brody. And I'm like, my heart just sinks because they would always put me, because I bump really well for these guys, you know. And I was like, oh, here we go. I'm just dreading it. Right. And,
I wish I'd have been a fly on the wall then.
Oh, it was terrible. And back then, you know, Brody had a reputation, you know, especially with all the job guys, he could get rough. I mean, but he was doing it to protect his own business, you know? So he had apparently just been in Missouri and I'd heard stories about how he beat the living shit out of one of the job guys down there. And I'm just sitting there thinking, please, God, please don't put me in the ring with this guy, please. Right. So, Vern comes over, it was Wally Carbo comes over and goes, me and my buddy, hey, we're going to have you guys work a handicap match with Bruiser Brody. And I'm like, ah, fuck. Right. And literally like just a couple weeks before, I was in Missouri and Bill Irwin's brother, Scott Irwin, he was the Super Destroyer. I'm sure it was because I was some dumb kid. He was trying to smart me up in a ring and he was hitting me in the back of the head as hard as he could and just repeatedly doing it. And I couldn't see out of my left eye for about a half an hour after he got done. And so I go up to Brody and I go, look, you know, Brody goes, hey, Morgan, you kid. And I go, He goes, just fight back. Just fight back. I go, oh, okay. Well, you know, I just, if you would, you know, whatever you do, sir, just don't hit me in the head. And I explained what had happened a couple weeks ago. He goes, don't worry, kid. So we go out there and he just starts eating us up. You know what I mean? He's just mowing us down. And you know how you can feel the rhythm of the match. Dutch will know what I'm talking about, where you know the finish is just about to come up, right? He does that huge jumping knee, and I'm like, there's no way I'm taking this. I'm going to make sure I'm on the outside of the ring before that happens. Well, he has me by the back of the head. He walks over, lifts up his leg, just kicks straight out, and smashes, kicks my partner's face, right? Kicks him so hard that he's hanging on the rope, and he doesn't bump. And I hear Brody growl, and he goes, take a bump, kid, and kicks him again. His nose just goes, whoosh, and he shoots off the side of the ring and hits the cement, slides away. Brody slams me, goes, don't move. I see him out of the corner of my eye, go way over in the corner, comes running, jumps up. I'm like, I'm going to die.
He's 10 feet in the air.
At least. I'm like, I'm going to die. And he drops, never touches me. Hooks my leg, tells me thank you. And I was like, oh my God, somebody must have been looking out for me. Because I thought that was the end of, I thought I was going to die. Came back to the back. He thanked me. I said, thank you for not hitting me in the head. He goes, I appreciate you fighting back, kid, but I'm just going to beat you up every time. I go, no problem.
You ever take an elbow from Abby Abdullah?
Oh, yeah. Oh, God.
Is that pretty solid?
It's very solid, yeah.
No kidding. Yeah. Somebody told me we talked about
big,
it yesterday.
You know,
he's so big.
He, remember, back then he couldn't even zip up his boots. He couldn't bend over to zip up
his
boots.
He don't do an elbow drop. He does a body drop.
He just drops his whole body on you.
He hit me with it one time. I went, I had the same reaction you had when Bradshaw hit you with that clothesline. Jesus fucking Christ. Except I didn't say nothing. I just got up and left. So you got one more question, James, so we can let this man go to his training class.
A few people wrote in and said, have you got any funny stories or otherwise of star maker Kenny Bolin?
Star maker Kenny Bolin? Oh, I got plenty of stories about old star maker Kenny Bolin. He is a rare bird, that is
breed.
Sure.
Yes, he is.
Oh, he is. Kenny will tell you the story himself. And this is the best way I can, when people ask me about Kenny, I can tell you there used to be a grocery store, a shopping market where named Kroger's, and they did a double your money back meat offer. So if you would buy meat and you weren't satisfied with it, you would return the meat when that was uneaten and you get double your money back. So Kenny figures this out and starts going to different stores around the city, and he's buying like a huge roast. It's like 7 or 8 pounds. It costs like at that time, like $100. He eats half of it, takes it back to another store that he didn't buy it from with the receipt, so they don't recognize him. He then gets $200 back. So he starts doing this and builds a territory of stores. And then it starts, this was the best part. He starts now basically franchising it out to his family members. And they did this for at least a year with this double your money back meat scam until Ma Bolin, the mother, went in the same store twice and got caught. And then Kroger's cut the program off. So that right there. And when he tells you the story, he's proud of it. He was able to figure it out. So that pretty much.
Are you claiming that Kenny Bolin may have scammed somebody? Are you saying that?
I didn't claim anything. Kenny proudly proclaimed that he scammed people.
You know, yeah, he'd be bummed out if you said scam. He preferred meat opportunity rather than meat scam.
Opportunity, yes, that's it's all about opportunity for him. And he's not
that guy's not boring, is he?
Never.
I don't care what you got. He's
I think Dutch will attest. When I broke in 1982, and Dutch, you can every single person in this business were one, some of the most intelligent, most eclectic, most eccentric people you'd ever meet. And you knew that if they were not in the wrestling business, they'd be in jail somewhere.
A lot of them, I could say that is true.
Yes.
And they are creative. They are entertaining.
Yes.
And if they had to work a regular job, they'd go nuts.
They'd go nuts. Yeah, they'd go nuts.
They couldn't do it.
Couldn't do it.
What's your final question there, Mr. James?
Oh, that was my final question. I can always ask more, but we've got to let Al go.
We got to let him go, folks. I'd like to have you back on.
I'd love to. Yeah.
Yeah, because you're one of my favorite people in the business. I always enjoyed being around you.
He says that to everyone.
No, I've only said this to Al. I didn't say this to Kenny Bolin, did I?
No, no, in fairness, you didn't.
I said, Kenny, you're an entertaining son of a bitch. Now get the hell out of here. No, I didn't. I like Kenny. Listen, go to your class, teach those guys, tell them you just did one hell of a interview on Storytime with Dutch. And folks, if you want to be a wrestler or just pass it around, it was OVWacademy.com, correct?
Yep.
Right there. Yep. And he'll set you straight. He'll be right back to you. So until we're back next week, ladies and gentlemen, and Mr. Al, you can join us.
Yes.
We the people.